Okay.
Hello, everyone. Thank you all for joining. As you join, please push star 6 to mute yourself. We are here today joined by the fabulous Sarah Armstrong. Sarah is celebrating her 44th year as an educator. She brought storytelling into her elementary school classroom in the 80s and has included stories in her workshops with teachers since that time. She is intrigued with expanding conversations among people by sharing stories with no particular type or right answer and lots of perspectives. She is on the board of the, how do you say that?
O'ala Foundation.
Yes, for education, which shares its Awakening Wisdom curriculum that supports responsibility, responsiveness, respect, and resourcefulness among students, teachers, parents, and communities. You all please join me in welcoming Sarah as our facilitator and teller for today.
Hi. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. That was very, very nice, and it's really fun to be here. Usually when I do this workshop, I have people in front of me so I can make small groups to do talking and so on. So we're going to try to emulate that as best we can on this talk. So there will be times when I would hope you would unmute your phones and talk to me. So I want to sort of introduce you to how I got excited about this work. It was actually at an NSN conference several years ago. When Charles Temple had a session about Dilemma Stories for Democracy, and he was invited to come to a Slavic country and teach democracy. So he said I couldn't figure out exactly how to do that until I got thinking about stories. So the idea that stories have different perspectives that people can take and talk about, even if it might not be the one that they would originally choose, but to put themselves in somebody else's shoes. And of course, with students, and so you are going to hear me talk from my background of education, but I think it applies to all people interacting, to have students really try to push their own thinking and expand their thinking about whatever we're talking about, so that critical thinking and curiosity and listening and sharing their thoughts and understanding can be developed and make them more interesting people and interesting in their world and more able to collaborate and to learn from each other and to be just all they can be, as we say. So what I plan to do today is tell you some stories and try to simulate, as I said, a couple of activities and hopefully share some ideas that are perhaps a little different than you would have thought considering this topic, but I think they'll make sense. So the first story is a story probably every one of you knows, but I want to tell it because I want to bring it into this idea of taking on different perspectives. So the story is the cowtail switch, and it comes from, we believe, West Africa, although some of the folks from West Africa say, we don't know that story, but anyway, we'll assume that there is an aspect there that's familiar. And it's about Ogolusa, who was a great hunter for his village, and he would go out and bring game back, and he was an important person in that community. Well, he went out one day, and he had four sons and another on the way, and one of his sons saw the path that he took as he walked out into the area to go hunting. So he didn't come home that night, which wasn't much of a problem because many times he had to go far and wide for game. But he didn't come back the next night either, or the next night. And pretty soon people said, "Where's Ogolusa? Where's Ogolusa?" And nobody knew. And they talked about it for a while, and they would ask that once in a while. And then eventually people kind of forgot that he was gone. So the baby that his wife had been carrying was born, and his name was Puli, and he did baby things and started walking and started talking, and the first thing out of his mouth was, "Where is my father?" And suddenly everyone remembered that Ogolusa had been gone for a very long time. So one of his sons said, "I know the path that he took. I can show you the direction that he went. So he and his and three of his brothers went with him to see if they could find their father. Well, they hadn't gone very far down that path when they came to an open area where there were a scattering of bones and there was Ogallala's spear. And so they knew that their father had come to a bad end, probably from a wild animal. But one of the sons said, oh, I can put that skeleton together and put the organs in it and the sinews and the muscles and the skin on it and the blood, and he will be as he will look as he once did, and he did. Another son said, I can breathe the breath of life into him, which includes having his heart start beating, his lungs expanding and contracting, and he did. And another son said, well, I can give him back his speech and movement. And he did, and Ogallala sat up, picked up his spear, and said, let us go home, and led his sons back to the village. Well, everybody was so glad to see him. His wife took him into their hut and shaved his head and did the ritual activities that they had to do for someone who had essentially come back from the dead. And after a while, when that was done, Ogallala said, let us have a feast, and slaughtered a cow, and took the tail and made a beautiful switch with beads and shells and decorated it. It was just a beautiful thing. And he carried that switch with him and gathered everybody from the village to the feast. And everybody came and people started looking at that cowtail switch and saying, gosh, I'd like that cowtail switch. Who gets that cowtail switch? What are you going to do with your cowtail switch? And I'm going to pause for a moment here and ask each of you to think of your favorite number between 1 and 5. So I'm going to give you 10 seconds to do that. Your favorite number between 1 and 5. And the people who chose number 1, if you would please take a minute to think about how you would convince the rest of us that the son who knew the path that his father took should get that cowtail switch. People who took number 2, please take a minute to coordinate your argument as to why the son who put together the skeleton and the organs and the skin and the blood should get that cowtail switch. People who took number 3, please take a minute to think about the argument as to why the son who breathed the breath of life with a heart beating heart and the lungs expanding and contracting should get that cowtail switch. People who pick number 4, please take 1 minute to think about the son who was able to provide speech and movement to his father should get that switch. And people who took number 5, please take 1 minute to put the argument forth as to why Puli, the son who said, where is my father, should get that cowtail switch. And I'm going to give you 1 minute, and then I would love to have people unmute as we go through the arguments that people have from their perspective. So 1 minute, please. So a minute's a really long time when you can't see people's faces. So I would like the people who chose number 1 as your favorite number, and I hope somebody did, please unmute your phone and tell us why the son who identified the path his father went should get that cowtail switch. Number 1.
Well, let's see. Nothing could have happened if they hadn't found the father, if they hadn't followed the path. the person who follows, who knows the path, is the one who makes the story go forward. So I think we wouldn't have a story if we didn't have a number one.
Okay, thank you. Any other number ones? Okay, so number two, who said the son with the skeleton, who put together the skeleton, the organs, the blood, and the skin, why should that son get the cowtail switch? No number two?
Well, I could argue number two as well.
Thank you.
You don't want to have a human being like a worm. I mean, if you discovered the man and put it back together again, if he didn't have a skeleton, then he'd just be flopping about like a worm, or, you know, no substance to him at all.
Okay, thank you. Okay, number three. Why should the son who breathed the breath of life in to his father with his breathing and his heart beating, why should that son get the cowtail switch?
I think the breath of life
Sarah, this is Cheryl. I just had a question. You had given us 1 through 10. Was that intentional, or was it supposed to be 1 through 5?
1 through 5.
Okay. Because I thought it was 1 through 10, and I picked 7, and I wondered if there are others who picked a number above 5.
Oh, yeah. I beg your pardon. Did I say that? Oh, I'm so sorry.
Okay.
1 through 5. I meant to say 1
through
5. But somebody
was thinking
about
3.
Yeah.
All right. Let Harry...
And I actually picked 3 because I wasn't thinking in terms of the sons. And I like the number 3. But to me, the breath of life, I mean, it's such a powerful image. And in a sense, but you could have had the breath of life if you didn't have the body and you didn't know where the father was. And you could have had language and return if it wasn't. So it was just, to me, it was just the most critical element. And
okay.
It's just such a powerful image.
Okay, okay.
I didn't choose 3, but the father is, for me, representative of tradition. And so to breathe life into a tradition that had somehow gotten lost is a powerful and important thing to do. So that I don't know that the son should get the cowtail switch because I've got another thought about that. But I know that breathing life into a tradition, it makes it come back to memory, come back into visibility, and if it's a tradition that needs to continue or if it's a tradition that needs to be questioned, having that life through voice given that tradition is important.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Okay, and who would like to comment about the son who provided the speech and movement to his father?
Would.
Thank you. Please.
I'm Gail. Speech is what moves our bodies and our minds, and it's more powerful than anything because it can help in so many different ways. So I know the answer is number 5, but my lucky number is 4, and speech is the thing that seems to drive the world.
Okay. In our
Hi,
story.
This is Susie in Albuquerque.
In a bad way.
And the reason I chose it, because when I think of speech, of course, I immediately think of story.
Yep.
And he would be able now to tell the story of what happened. And with movement, he would be able to travel so that story would live and be told everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Very nice. Anybody else for number 4?
Again.
Okay, and those of you who chose number five, Pooley, why should Pooley get the cow-tail switch?
We know.
I think calling attention to the fact that the father was not visible any longer. What happened?
Mm-hmm.
What happened? And then it's like having a light beam on. And you go, everybody else is like, I don't know why I didn't think about that. I have no idea, but good on you for thinking about it. And then it calls out of everyone their own abilities to contribute to the revival of that tradition, of story. When we all breathe into story, when we put flesh and bone onto story, when we do all of that, but all of us together makes that happen, but somebody has to call attention to it sometime so that we can all then put our heads together, our hearts together, our visions together, all of that to create what needs to be created at the time.
Lovely.
And of course, when someone is mentioned, he is not gone. We all see the person. We all remember the person. So as long as some people mention him, he's still there.
That's right. So usually when the story is told, Pooley is the one who would get the cowtail switch because, as you said, if he didn't speak up, nothing would have happened. So, but I also learned that in some communities, it's going to be the eldest son, no matter what, who gets the switch. So just for that. So what I usually do when I do this and I have people in front of me is have them count off 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6, or 7, however many sons you want to have, and then have them talk in groups about the argument that would convince everybody else that that son should get the switch, just so they could take on that perspective. Because in the past, if we've done it and said, here are the sons who should get the cowtail switch, everybody would probably go to Pooley. But to get people to be thinking about other perspectives, as you have done, and share is what I wanted to do, what we want to do with this kind of dilemma, that there are possibilities other than perhaps the most obvious one or the one that we could come to first. So right. I wanted to share with you kind of a context for all this that has to do with brain research work and the growth mindset, which, as you know, is the idea that you aren't just born with how smart you are or what you know or what you can know, but with a growth mindset, it opens up the whole world to you, and anybody can learn anything, we believe, with their motivation and the proper environment and the information that they need. I recently heard about some research by Jo Bowler, who is at Stanford. And her website is youcubed, youcubed.org. And she's got a lot of resources there. Her main focus was math, but it really applies to every topic. That when research that was done was that I was most excited about was when people, and I'm putting this in quotes, fail, that all kinds of synapses fire in your brain, and that is, as opposed to when you give the right answer, not much goes on. And I think that's fascinating. And she also found that even if you don't know that you have been in error, the synapses are firing. And it reminded me of the Nelson Mandela quote that says, sometimes I win and sometimes I learn something. So the idea that questioning, curiosity, trying things out, being in an environment where it doesn't matter and failure, quote unquote, is encouraged. I love the acronym for FAIL is First Attempt in Learning. So the idea that all our ideas are important and add to the whole and take us into different thoughts, as I think or Wami Jean said about ideas that we hadn't thought of that can then enhance what we're doing and what we're thinking and where we can move forward. So I wanted to make sure you knew about that research, and I'm happy to share the websites that I'm going to talk about today a little bit, wherever that makes sense. So that brain research work, I think, is very powerful, and the idea that encouraging curiosity and encouraging people to try things out as often as possible and check out different perspectives is what we're all about. And I think stories, of course, allow us to do that in a really lovely way. Okay, so I want to tell you, or remind you, because I know you all know this one, remind you of another story and then tell you about a little activity that we've done that maybe put a little bit different perspective on that. And that's the story of a young man named Jack who lived with his mother and their cow, and they were very poor. And the day came when his mother said, "Jack, we have nothing, we have no food, we have nothing, so except for Bessie the cow. So please take Bessie to market and get the best price you can for him so we can survive, so we can have food and we can keep on living." So Jack took Bessie, started down the path, and hadn't gone very far when he saw sort of a strange-looking little man who said, "Hi, Jack." And Jack said, "How do you know my name?" He said, "Oh, I know your name, and I think I know what you're about. Are you selling your cow?" And Jack said, "Well, why, yes, I am. I'm taking her to market to get the best price I can." And the man said, "Well, I'll buy your cow from you." And Jack said, "Really? That's great. For what will you give me? How much money?" And the man said, "Well, it's not money, but it's magic beans I have, very, very special beans. You plant those beans, and tomorrow morning there'll be a stalk that goes up to the sky, a beanstalk that goes up to the sky, and it's magic." And Jack said, "Well, that sounds very interesting." And he traded the cow for the magic bean. Well, he went home, and his mother said, "Oh, you're home so quickly? Jack, what did you get for the cow?" And Jack said, "Well, I got these magic beans." And she said, "Magic beans? Beans aren't magic. That's terrible. Now we have absolutely nothing. We'll starve." And she started to cry. And he was so upset by seeing his mother cry, he ran up to his room, threw the beans out the window, and went to sleep. Well, the next morning he woke up, and the light was really strange coming in from his window. And he looked out, and there was a beanstalk. So he climbed the beanstalk way, 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 way up, and he walked at the top of it and found himself by a large castle. And he was about to knock on the door when it was opened by a huge woman who said, "Oh, I haven't been able to feed a boy breakfast for so long. Please come in." And she fed him breakfast, and then he started feeling the ground quaking and hearing fee-fi-fo-fum. And in was coming the giantess's husband. She said, "Oh, you must hide, you must hide." And so she put him in a copper pot, and the giant came in and said, "Fee-fi-fo-fum, I smell the blood of an Englishman." And she said, "Oh, no, there hasn't been an Englishman here for years and years. Let me make you your breakfast." So she did, and he fell asleep to the sound of a magic harp. And the harp looked very sad and thin, and next to the harp was a chicken, a hen, who had laid a golden egg, and the hen looked a little sick and was not good for either of them. And Jack came out of the giant's wife opened the pot. Jack came out and started to run, and the harp said, "Don't leave us, don't leave us." So he grabbed the harp and he grabbed the hen and he headed for the door, and he just about got there when the giant woke up and heard the harp and came running after, and you know the rest. Jack got to the beanstalk before the giant, shinnied down the beanstalk, took an axe and chopped it down, and the giant who had just started down fell to his death. Well, the rest of the story goes that Jack and his mother took care of the chicken, took care of the harp, who only wanted to be singing, free to sing and play the harp for everyone, and the hen laid golden eggs, became healthy again, and Jack and his mother shared their largesse with the whole community, and nobody ever went hungry again who lived around them. So that's the story of Jack and the Beanstalk. And so the question I have for you, or the activity that we often do, is have a time or a big rope, a big line, and at one end it says hero, and at the other end it says villain. So what I want you to do is just take a few moments to think about where you would place yourself on that timeline or on that continuum. Is Jack a hero or is he a villain or somewhere in between? And just share your thoughts about where you would be on that continuum and why. So please unmute and share your thoughts.
Well, some people, this is Gail, some people would say that even though he did the deed of selling the cow for the magic beans unknowingly, that really he might have had some kind of intuition that this wasn't a bad thing. So maybe he is part hero.
So you'd be towards that end, but not quite all the way?
Probably not.
Okay.
But yes, he might have had some kind of intuitive note about this gentleman that he saw and taking such a little bit of beans, you know. But, I mean, there was hope in it. There was magic.
Okay.
Young boy.
Yes. Other thoughts?
This is Elisa. I think many heroes don't start off on the path as heroes. They're just regular people in a dilemma. And through the challenges, they become more heroic for you know, trying to solve problems creatively. And so I agree about the intuition. He was open to things, and he also showed generosity and kindness.
Yes.
Okay. Anybody really disagree with our friends?
Yeah, I guess so. I think Jack was kind of living his own narrative there, and from his point of view, everything he did was right. You know, he followed his own bliss, as Joseph Campbell would say. And all that was to the good. And then he was able to steal all those things and then killed the giant and then left the giant's wife all up there in the sky without any means of support. So it does call into question, you know, whose hero are you? Are you your own, or are you doing good for the greater population? So I would rate him a little bit further down the scale on reflection.
And would you be really towards the far end as a villain, or more towards the middle, or where would you be?
I would be a little bit closer to the villain, I think.
Okay. Any other thoughts?
Well, when you put it that way.
Yeah, Jack, an accidental... Jack is an accidental hero. This is on a woman. He's an accidental hero because, first of all, he's young.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And he's been taught well. His mom has done a good job with him. But he's a little full of himself, you know, and he's a charmer because instead of trying to eat him, the giant's wife was like, oh, you cute little thing, jump in here and I'll just deflect this thing. So he gets a lot of good stuff happening to him. And when he flings beans, he doesn't fling the beans with the idea of, wow, there's going to be a big beanstalk outside of my house, and it's going to be a life changer.
Yeah.
I would call him an accidental hero.
Okay.
And if that...
I love that. I didn't even saw there. I wouldn't even call him a hero. I mean, what's the definition of hero? You know, somebody whose intention is, you know, leads to great outcomes. And so just like she was saying, you know, he threw the beans out of the window out of desperation. You know, good came of it, but it certainly wasn't an act of heroism.
Yeah.
And he did the right thing by chopping down the beanstalk to prevent the giant from getting down. So maybe he gets a little...
He was a good pragmatist. he knew this beanstalk had to go because this giant was not going to be a friend of his. I mean, this guy was going to eat him up. And that, I think, has to do with, for me, this is on a woman, for me, in this 21st century, what are we doing with the giants that are coming after us? Mm-hmm. We're writing stories that will alert people to them. We're throwing our beans out intentionally. We're trying to wake people up with it. But we know that there are certain factors that are at work in our 21st century that require us to do things. But Jack, I like Jack because Jack is I like him because he was like me and like a lot of folks. You do something and it turns out well. You go, damn, I had no idea. You know, that's pretty cool. I like that, but don't try to then turn me into this paragon. I have to be honest with myself and say to myself, thank God, I had no idea. You know. Yeah.
Well said. So you can imagine, I hope, that in a group that's face-to-face, you'll get good conversations wherever you are on that continuum about, you know, why people have placed themselves where they place themselves.
Can everyone, excuse me for a second, can everyone please push star six to mute? We have a little bit of feedback. Thank you.
So I wanted to call your attention to the Right Question Institute. This is an organization that was founded by some folks who, actually, one of the partners is a woman who is an immigrant to this country, not an original English speaker, and she, in then working with other folks who came, realized that people were just felt they didn't have the right questions to ask when they went to school, their children's school, or to the doctor, or whatever, and so Lou Santana is the woman, and she said, so what we did was we created a list of questions for them, which didn't work. And so the whole point is you have to be able to come up with your own questions. And so they have some wonderful materials for educators and a whole process for brainstorming that I love a lot. It's called the Right Question Institute, rightquestion.org. And there's another person named Warren Berger who's taken that farther. And his website is A More Beautiful Question, which is also the name of his book. And he said his seminal experience or that he writes about is about the man who created the cheetah prosthetic leg. And it was a man who was an athlete, a runner, who lost his leg in a boating accident and wanted to be running again. And every prosthesis that he tried, he'd fall right over. So he started asking himself the questions, well, why is this such a problem? What else, what if there were something done differently that I could adapt? Or he didn't quite get to that point, but started looking at all kinds of possibilities and watched animals run, and the cheetah was the one that really inspired him. And then the third question is how? How can I make this a reality? How can I make this a reality? And he did. And then his next question is, then how can we bring this to third world countries or bring the cost down so that it's feasible in all over the world? So the questions were why, what if, and how. And that process is one that drives a lot of innovation, a lot of thinking, a lot of that open mindset. So the questions that we ask and the questions that we pursue are the ones that spark those brain synapses and the interest and the expansion of learning and understanding that we can bring into the world. So I share that with you for that reason as well. Okay, I have another little story for you, and this is called The Old People and the Bear, and it comes from Turkestan, so along the Silk Road Trail, or Silk Road, the Silk Road, and it's about an old couple who lived apart from the village and had to make their living as best they could. And the way they made their living was the husband would go out into the woods and collect thistles and sell them or trade them. And first I read this and heard it, I said, thistles? But then I learned that thistles have a lot of interesting properties, medicinal as well as food for animals and so on. So certainly something that is of value to some folks. But the day came when there was snow everywhere, and the husband went out and he couldn't find anything, and he came back very discouraged. And his wife said, well, let's go on top of our house, and maybe we can see farther than you can see just walking. And so they went on the top of their house, and a little ways away there was a growth of reeds. So they went over to the reeds and started pulling the reeds up, and there was a door. And they opened that door, and through the door they could see a whole different land and a path leading up to a house. And they went through the door and started on the path and immediately noticed the delicious smells of food that were coming from that house. So they followed the path, and it wound and it wound, and it went up to a courtyard in front of a house. And in that courtyard were some vats of food. There were sausages that were being fried. There was a delicious soup. There were dumplings, just the most wonderful food all ready. So no one was around, so they started eating because they were very hungry. And as they were eating and enjoying the delicious food, the old woman happened to look down at the end of the path because she heard a sound, and there were several bears beating on a tambourine starting to walk up that path, and she realized this was their home. So she told her husband, we've got to hide, we've got to hide. The bears are coming back, and they'll find us. And they looked around, and there was nothing they could see immediately where they could hide, except in the corner there was a huge pile of ashes. So they went and got into the ashes and were able to cover themselves completely just as the bears came into the courtyard and started kind of looking around. And the husband said to his wife, the ashes are in my nose. I'm going to have to sneeze. And she said, no, you can't. They'll discover it. But he couldn't hold it. And he sneezed, and the ashes flew up and through the air. And the bears, so startled, were afraid that there was a demon in their courtyard. And so they ran down the path and into the woods to get the mullah to come and help them get rid of the demon. Well, the old people saw the bears running and disappearing, and they went back to eating because they were still very hungry. So they were eating the delicious food, and again, thank goodness, the old woman looked down the path and saw the bears coming up the path with the mullah with his turban in the lead, marching up the path, and she said, we've got to hide, we've got to hide. And they looked all around, and there was a huge covered vat that was empty. And so they were able to jump into that vat and pull the top down just as the mullah and the bears came into the yard. And the bears looked around for some place for the mullah to sit because it wouldn't be proper for him to sit on the ground. And what did they see, of course, but the vat in which the old people were hiding. So the mullah started to sit down on that vat, and for some reason part of his tunic went down inside the vat, and the woman thought it was her husband trying to escape, so she pulled on it, and the mullah leapt up and ran out of the courtyard with the bears behind him, and they ran so far, the story goes, they couldn't find their way back. So the old couple looked around, found rice and other provisions, as well as those wonderful vats full of food, and took over the house and lived happily ever after. So I'll tell you a couple things. When at an NSN conference a couple years ago, Maria Ask from the Children's Theater Group came and did a wonderful workshop with activities that her group has developed for working with kids in school. And she told the story of the Pied Piper of Hamelin and then had groups take on the project of telling the rest of the story or the next part of the story after the children disappear from the perspective of the parents who lost their children, of the city council who were the ones who didn't pay, invited the Pied Piper but didn't pay, and the rest, who've gotten the bad rap. So I've used the old people in the bear story to do the same thing, to have people take the perspective of the old people, people take the perspective of the mullah, and people take the perspective of the bears and say, what would come next?
And so again, it's, I'm thinking that that would be just a really intriguing exercise if we hadn't run out of time. But at this point, we are kind of coming up on the time where we need to open things up for questions. So I just wanted to thank you for such brilliance and for reminding us of the importance of examining various perspectives, for letting us know that your hero is not necessarily my hero and might be an accidental hero, and the brilliant expose around neuroscience of story and the importance of asking powerful questions. You've just given us so, so much.
I'm so glad. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so, so much. And we usually kind of keep things open for about 15 minutes for questions. Is that okay with you?
That's fine, and that's where I was heading, just to let you know that that would be, that's an activity that has been very powerful, as you can imagine, with folks, again, taking a different perspective. But, yes, I'm absolutely open for questions, and I thank you so much for inviting me to come and share thoughts with you.
You are very, very welcome. Who's got the first question? Unmute your phones and let's get some questions out for Sarah.
Oh, this is Elisa, and I guess I'm wondering, going on about different perspectives, what you notice when you do this with young people, just any insights you've had, any observations you've made about how it might help them to think in new ways.
Well, the most important thing, as you all know, is the environment where it's safe to disagree. So that's key, creating the environment, creating the trust, and the relationship with the people that you're working with, whatever age they are, so that that idea of my opinion is valuable and it's as good as anybody else's, and then challenging kids to take a different idea, different perspective. And when you can do that and allow that, and kids really understand that it's true, you know, you will listen to them, you will care about their thoughts, and they care about each other's thoughts. So it can be a process, of course, building that environment of trust. But the idea that kids then take what they've done and what they've thought about into their different aspects of their schoolwork, for example, is a natural outcome of it. So encouraging curiosity and creativity and thinking and questioning is going to stand them in good stead in whatever they're working on.
Right.
Sarah, this is Cheryl. I wondered if there is, in your opinion, a secret sauce to creating that kind of safety.
Well, the founders of the Huala Foundation said, "You teach who you are." So each of us needs to be understanding of who we are, and we're always modeling, which, of course, as you know, is the most powerful teacher. So when we're modeling and believe in the idea that we trust each other and that we care about each other and that we value each other's opinions, that we will listen and do the best we can to have that situation all the time, that's the secret sauce, is being real and caring, I think. And you all know that, I know.
Thank you.
This is Charlie Temple, and Sarah, I'm so delighted with this whole thing.
Well, it's you. You were my inspiration. I can't believe it. So I hope I've done you well.
Oh, you certainly have, and you've taught me things. I just wanted to point out, when I started doing this work in post-socialist countries where people had just really been taught that there was only one idea, that this kind of exercise was like a can opener for people to realize that there really were more, there were many perspectives on any issue. And I keep thinking of the present time when the people who are for Trump no matter what, and the rest of us just don't get it. That I don't know if this can bridge the gap or not, but telling stories that you, and asking people to take the other person's point of view is just the cornerstone of democracy, it seems to me.
Yeah, yeah. And I did give you credit, right? I did know your name early on, right?
Oh, I'm thrilled. Thank you very much.
Well, it's been, you opened the door for all of this for me, too, and I just thank you so much. And it's wonderful to hear your voice.
Wonderful to hear yours.
Well, thank you.
I love the way you hold yourself mysterious until the end, Charlie. That's fantastic.
Oh, no.
I love that. That's great.
Say the name again. But
can I tell you a quick story about the cowtail switch? Because I told that story to a group of teachers in Liberia, and none of them guessed Pooley. None of them. And there was a woman from Washington, D.C., who just happened to be visiting, and she was in the room. And she said, well, of course it was Pooley. And everybody said, you're crazy. And I couldn't figure out why everybody thought it was everybody else. And then, as you said, somebody explained later, well, in our culture, it's always the oldest child who would be the one that you bestow it to. And I began to realize how strong the pull of culture was in this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Super. And I also heard, too, that people say from Liberia say, not our story, but that's fascinating as well, how stories travel.
Absolutely.
So somebody said, what is your name? Charles Temple. Charles Temple. And did you finish your book so we can buy your book?
Well, I've written other books in that, and I'm still working on a book on just this to see if we can't get it published for the storytelling community. Because
right.
I really think storytellers go out and they tell stories, but traditionally, it is a way to get conversations going among people to share perspectives in that.
Yep.
This is Cheryl. I just have to say that I've only met you one time, Charles Temple, and when I did meet you, I said, I know you from somewhere, and I knew your voice, only having met you one time. It was like, that's Charles Temple that she just mentioned.
Oh, super. Well,
and
thank you for mentioning that I did get credit. I thought I had.
You did. You did.
No, of course you did. No, of course you did.
Okay.
I wonder if any of you know about the book Dilemma Tales by Bascom. This is Gail Herman. It's in the University of Connecticut Library, and it is a book that gives every dilemma tale from every group of people all throughout Africa, not by country, but by kin, by the group. And it's a wonderful book. It's called Dilemma Tales. And it's by Bascom, B-A-S-C-O-M. I can put it on the listserv. If you can get it, it's a very old book, but it has, you know, literally hundreds.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you.
And I've been telling you for years.
I just looked it up on Amazon, and it cost $157.
Yeah, but that's a very well-known.
When they do the cowtail switch in that book, all of the versions have a right answer that is not Pooley, except for the one by Harold Corlander. This actually won a Newbery Award. It was a collection of books, a collection of stories years ago, and I have a feeling he doctored it to make it Pooley. But
to have them, yeah.
I'm not sure you have the right book, because the Bascom book is specifically about how old African cultures use the dilemma tale to find the young leaders and counselors of their group. So they would listen to their comments about who should get, you know, the reward or whatever. And then by everyone listening to how the people were responding to the dilemmas, it showed wisdom and it showed ability to, you know, put forth a logical or a kind, you know, conclusion. But So it was sort of like a speech thing, as I recall.
Fascinating.
So anyway, it's a resource. I'll get the reference for you.
I love you, Gail Herman. I just love you.
I love you, Wonder Woman.
My God. You stay on top of everything. And you're so generous in the way that you share, all of you. I'm so glad I'm a storyteller. Now, I'm not the best storyteller, but I am just absolutely a working storyteller. This is great. Great. Sarah, thank you so much for the work that you do to bring us, you know, the insights from that you've gained from your work and to give us an opportunity to come and voice. You come and voice with Dilemma Tales. The whatever it is the Bascom book says, African writers that I have read have said that the whole purpose of the dilemma tale or the cautionary tale or the fable is for the community to gather because something has happened to make that story necessary so that the community could be self-reflective, which of course we know to be Socratic, and to be reflective on what is going on in the community. And because Africans in the ancient days would not resort to calling somebody a nasty name, they would use animals as metaphors. But each animal represented whoever the ones that were contributing to the problem, each animal represented that particular person.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
So the hope is that you would see yourself in the story and see yourself as a contributor to the dilemma that caused the story to have to come into being. And so I'm very interested in how these ancient dilemma tales have us somehow reflected in them as well, but perhaps will inspire us to write 21st century dilemma tales.
Oh, super, yeah.
That will cast on what's happening in the here and now.
Yes.
I think that's a great idea. That's a great idea, Mama Jane.
And I
want to share with you, if I can, really quickly before we come to our end, the next couple of teleconferences that we have on the horizon. On April 19th, in honor of Earth Day, we have Jenny Cargill-Strong, our talented executive committee member from Australia, who's going to tell stories inspired by the work of Joanna Macy, Eco-Psychology, and her own original work. She'll talk about creating environmental stories that inspire love of the earth and much more, and that'll be on April 19th. And then on May 24th, we're going to have Matthew Hopwood from the U.K., and he's going to stay up until 3 a.m. in the morning to share his program called Love Stories Can Change the World. Matt has spent the last 4 years walking around England and is currently in Scotland gathering people's love stories, not necessarily romantic stories, but the stories that describe our vulnerability and aliveness that create connection and strengthen community. He'll share some of the stories and describe his work and his understanding of how important these stories can be in creating cohesive communities. And then for June, I went all the way to Mama Jean's house last week trying to talk her into being the storyteller for June. I still don't have an answer on that yet, Elisa. So.
And until you call me Mama Onawumi, I'm not going to give you one.
Is there anyone else from the executive board on the phone, Allison or Pearl or anyone else from the executive board from Healing Story Alliance? I just want to say hello to you. Guess not tonight. So, Elisa, thank you so much for your leadership. And, Sarah, thank you so much for being with us tonight. We have a few more minutes if there's maybe one more question, and then we'll close.
I'd like to say something.
Yes.
Hello?
Yes,
yes.
Go ahead.
Hi, this is Fran Stallings in the corner.
Hi, Fran.
Hi, Fran.
Hey, Fran.
Hey, I looked up that book on Amazon also, and it is 150 or 250. But hey, guys, interlibrary loan.
Yes.
They can find you anything. I've been running them ragged looking for eclipse stories, and they can get the most amazing things. Some things that probably should not have been shipped across country in their condition, but they'll get them for you.
Wow, great.
Try for that.
But do look it up, and do look and look at the cowtail switch. I think I'm right about that. The versions that they reproduced, except for Harold Corlander's, were not so open ended. Although I think we all agree that they're better if they are.
Yeah, I have a comment about that activity. Also, I've done it a lot with fifth and sixth grade kids, counting them off and dividing them up, and I've noticed that on occasion girls will refuse to play that game.
Wow.
Huh. Wow.
They'll say it's obvious that all the brothers needed each other. None of them could have
right.
done it alone.
Yeah.
Oh,
exactly.
Excellent.
But
exactly.
They, I mean, they just won't even play it as a thinking game.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we should retell it with Pooley being a girl.
We could, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you all again, Sarah. Thank you so much, and thank you all for joining tonight. We look forward to maybe seeing you or hearing from you on April 19th and May 24th.
And
thank
Cheryl,
you, everybody.
And Cheryl.
Thank you so
yes,
much.
You can. We'll talk. You got me.
I know.
Yay.
Dude, great event, y'all.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everyone.
Thanks,
good night.
Bye. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you, Sarah.